And it's Bill Bennett. It is Morning in America. Good morning again, everyone. Your education's about to begin on all things Iran, Iraq, Middle East, Israel, Turkey. Here is Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Good morning, Michael.
Morning, Bill.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Israel and the flotilla, what happened and what's going on in the international press? And what interesting kind of posture for the United States at this point, given what happened earlier this year with Israel and Netanyahu.
Well, certainly, I mean, it looks like the flotilla was a trap, obviously. I mean, it was meant as a public relations stunt, but normal public relations stunts don't have the sort of, if you will, weaponry or violence that this Turkish ship, the Mavi Marmara, was carrying. It was staffed by a Turkish charity, which I use the term charity loosely. The charity is listed as by the U.S. Treasury Department as a terror sponsor.
Mm-hmm.
And what I don't understand on the Israeli side is why they decided to act in international waters rather than wait until the ships were a little bit closer to Israeli territorial waters. But putting that aside,
what difference would that have made?
I think it would have just taken a little bit of the wind out of some of the critics. When push comes to shove, though, look, it's a publicity stunt because there is no blockade on Gaza. Food and medicine do get through all the time.
Whose publicity stunt was it? The Turks?
This is largely the Turks. It's largely Prime Minister Erdogan, who has allied himself with some of the most recalcitrant regimes. We recently saw him celebrating with Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad,
right,
with regard to, frankly, stymieing the UN sanctions or attempting to. But if we actually look at Prime Minister Erdogan more deeply, back in 2006, a lot of people forget this. This isn't his first run-in, if you will, with a charity. Prime Minister Erdogan got up and defended a gentleman named Yasin al-Qadi, who's defined by both the United Nations and the United States as a sponsor of al-Qaeda. And it turned out that not only Erdogan, but Erdogan's own mother had donated personal funds to this gentleman.
Mm-hmm. All right. And we saw a poll yesterday, Michael. It was interesting. Attitudes toward the United States, lowest esteem for the United States is held by people in Turkey.
That's true. And actually, this also goes
Why
back.
Would that be, by the way?
Why would that be? That's pretty easy. Back in 2006, or starting in, Prime Minister Erdogan came in 2002, and he's slowly taken over the state media. He's used the powers of tax liens and so forth to curtail any media critical of him, and he has used the media, once he puts his own people in charge, really to whip up sentiment towards both the United States generally and, frankly, much more specifically, Jews. Remember in 2006, there was a movie called Valley of the Wolves, which Erdogan's own wife endorsed and Erdogan's own party financiers financed, which depicted the Iraq War as a way to kill Arabs so that Jews could harvest their organs. It was that crude. Likewise, Mein Kampf, in 2005, became a bestseller in Turkey. Why did it become a bestseller? I mean, anyone who's ever tried to read it knows how thick and impenetrable it is. It's because somehow Erdogan-affiliated charities subsidized the price so that people could get it.
Unbelievable. All right, now, when they did this, if it was a Turkish thing, they had the blessing of others, no doubt, right?
Most certainly, and what we're seeing is really the confluence of the traditional Islamism with leftism and this idea, if you will, among the chattering classes in Europe that somehow Israel is becoming increasingly illegitimate and people are working towards that end. Just contrast, Bill, the international outrage that occurred with regard to Israel storming this ship and killing between 9 and 15 people in a fight versus what happened when North Korea torpedoed a South Korean ship.
Yeah, it's a great point. Very little, right? Very little.
Very little. And the UN took instant action on this.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. We had David Horowitz on yesterday. You know who he is, the Jerusalem Post editor. He a lot of his analysis was internal. He said, we don't handle these things right. We get set up and we fall for these traps, he seemed to be saying. We need to manage this better. I don't know whether he was talking about public affairs or internal affairs or what. But do you have any idea what he might have meant?
I think he meant both. One of the issues is why Israel, again, did this out at sea when it became arguably an issue, as its adversaries would cast it, of international piracy, yeah, interfering in international waters rather than defending Israel's own territorial waters. But I'd go further than this, and it's not just Israel, it's the United States as well. In January of 2009, Prime Minister Erdogan threw a temper tantrum at the Davos World Forum when he was on a panel with Israeli President Adav, a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, Shimon Peres, where he got all Erdogan got all red-faced and accused Peres. He said, "You know well how to kill. You kill children on beaches and so forth," and then stormed off the stage. What did the Israelis do? They apologized for upsetting Erdogan. Now, 2 hours later, Erdogan arrived back in Turkey, and magically there was a rally at the airport with about 3,000 people, each with Palestinian flags that somehow materialized at 3 in the morning.
Yeah.
This was clearly, and Turks acknowledge, this was clearly pre-planned. So what the heck are the Israelis doing apologizing and casting themselves as somehow at fault? We do this all the time as well in the United States in our foreign policy, where we're apologizing to international rogues because somehow we think that that makes diplomacy more possible. What we don't realize is it simply encourages the rogues.
All right. So what Horovitz is saying is we need to learn to play this game better and smarter.
Indeed.
Yeah. All right. Now, the United States policy toward this, it seems to have been a little more supportive of Israel than we might have expected from recent actions. Is that a fair comment?
That is a fair comment. Although, on the other hand, if Obama hadn't needlessly squandered some of the diplomatic partnership between Washington and Jerusalem, he might have a little bit more wiggle room right now.
He squandered it where? In the earlier castigations?
Well, squandered it by acting more as a zoning commissioner for Jerusalem,
yeah,
than as the president of the United States.
So what happened? Blowback, you think, here? People called him and told him you can't do this? Big Democrat donors, others? Or did they just see the error of their ways on their own?
That may be part of it, but also what President Obama needs to be careful of is this idea that if Israel is going to get condemned roundly and internationally and maximally for defending itself, and we all know that Israel, perhaps no army other than the United States, takes so much care with regard to avoiding civilian casualties.
Yeah.
Now, if Israel's going to get condemned roundly for doing this, then eventually Israeli policymakers are going to say, what the heck, we're going to be condemned no matter what we do, so we might as well act with maximum force and make sure we fulfill our mission. That's number one. And number two is if Israel feels that it has no friends and no one is going to, if it feels it's suffering an existential crisis and no one is going to defend it, then what President Obama must realize is Israel is much more likely to take matters in its own hands. And, of course, the Iranian nuclear crisis is what looms large here.
Yeah. Yeah, we're reporting on Iran. We'd like you to stay another segment because we got more questions. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
Let's deal with this one. Crackdown, we read this morning by Iran. Oh, yesterday's story was about the development of more nuclear material, enough for 2 nuclear warheads. Today's story is about a crackdown on women, loose veils as a security risk. What's going on over there?
Well, I mean, people forget Iran is an ideological republic, and it really is trying to isolate, the Iranian government is trying to isolate it. Look, there's crackdowns on women in Iran all the time. There were crackdowns on women when I was there. The big picture is just to remember that throughout the Middle East, women are fighting for rights they never had. In Iran, women are fighting for rights that were taken away from them.
What happened to the revolution? What happened to the Green Revolution? Is it gone? Is it over?
No, the Iranians are scared to death of what could happen. In the near term, it looks like the security services and specifically the Revolutionary Guard were able to put out the wildfires, but we're nearing on June 12th, the anniversary of the Green Movement, so it will be interesting to see what happens. And at the very least, it's very clear that the Iranian government has no confidence in its own survival, given the antipathy its people have towards it.
10-second answer. Is Netta still remembered?
Yes, very much so. She has become the symbol.
Good. We'll be back with Michael Rubin, resident scholar of the American Enterprise Institute, Fume Prize Institute. Let me ask you this. We talked a little about Turkey, a little bit about Iran. I just finished War, the Sebastian Junger book. He talks about the fights going on in eastern Afghanistan. Complaint of a lot of the soldiers is they said they see these guys going to and fro from Pakistan. Is there still a lot of movement of fighters from Pakistan?
Oh, yeah. And one of the greatest ironies here, which people forget, is that in 1961, Pakistan got so upset with Afghanistan that 50 years ago they managed to seal their border when they refused to today. But when we actually ask the Pakistanis, hey, how come you're letting these guys go back and forth, the Pakistanis will say, look, we don't have the night vision goggles, we don't have the communications gear, we don't know whether it's special forces, Taliban, Al-Qaeda, American Army, whatever, down there. So we will tell the Pakistanis, what do you need to secure that border? And they'll talk about, we need B-1 bombers, we need M-1, A-1 Abrams tanks, and everything that on the Pakistani shopping list has to do with the war with India, nothing that has to do with Afghanistan. And we seem to let the Pakistanis get away with this repeatedly.
It's funny, there's a kind of symmetry of expectation overlaying the belief that we're fighting the wrong war. A lot of people in Iraq said we should be at war with Iran. That's where a lot of the stuff's coming from. A lot of these soldiers in Afghanistan are saying we should be at war with Pakistan. That's where a lot of the soldiers and materials coming from.
Well, I mean, that's certainly true, and it's the problem when you have neighboring states that are certainly sympathetic, if not supporting, the insurgent and the terrorist movements. To be fair, when it comes to Pakistan, we are striking across the border, and legally we're able to do that more easily because the so-called Durand Line, the 1,610-mile border that's the Afghan-Pakistani border today, technically expired in 1993. It was only a 100-year border when it was set in 1893, and therefore, instead of picturing it as a sharp black magic marker line on a border, think of it as a dotted pencil line.
Can you stay with us for another segment?
Yeah, of course.
We got a lot of calls. I want to encourage people to call and learn from Michael, 866-680-6464. We're talking about everything going on in the Middle East and beyond. All right, that's fascinating. That is very interesting, and it does again indicate how many hotspots that we have in the world. How's it going in Afghanistan? What is your sense?
My sense is that it's going fairly well. The problem is that when we look back on Iraq and the surge, the surge was as much psychological as military. What's happened in Pakistan ever since the president's speech, I guess it was December 1st, at West Point, when he talked about how the United States would stay in the fight but then start withdrawing, I believe it was in July 2011,
yes,
what that
sir.
Did was it undercut the psychological strength of the surge. That's been further undercut when Hillary Clinton has offered Pakistan a seat at the table. What this has convinced our adversaries as well as our allies inside Afghanistan is that the United States is getting ready to cut and run, and therefore, rather than ally themselves with us or really rally around the Afghan government, what many groups are doing is turning towards their plan B and making accommodations with the Taliban or with the Pakistanis or others.
Yeah, it's a real mistake, too. What about the diplomatic side, quickly, Michael? We had heard the other day, big difference is that in Iraq, Ryan Crocker and Petraeus, it was seamless. In Afghanistan, Eikenberry and McChrystal doesn't work so well.
You put your finger on it, but remember, before we had that team of Ryan Crocker and General Petraeus, we had a dysfunctional team with Jerry Bremer and General Sanchez, and so it's up to the commander-in-chief to recognize there's a problem and fix it.
Yeah, and again, that hasn't been fixed, and not a lot of attention being paid to it. All right, we'll come back with Michael Rubin and your questions. Look at the board light up. Boy, this is your opportunity to find out anything you ever wanted to ask. No question is too simple, too dumb. There are no dumb questions. Anything to say, why are we fighting this fight? Why are we there? Why are we in this place? That's all perfectly legitimate. This guy knows the answers, and this guy trains our troops. This guy educates our troops. You might want to thank him for doing that. Our guys go into these countries knowing about them, thanks to Michael Rubin. We'll be right back. I'm Bill Bennett. It's Morning in America. Sunshine, then be on your way. And when are you?
and I have gone away. You'll often speak about me, and this is what you say. We sang in the sunshine, you know, we laughed every day. We sang in the sunshine since you.
Sunshine songs, sun songs. We're getting a lot of sun, getting a lot of light, certainly, with Michael Rubin, resident scholar of the American Enterprise Institute. We'll go to your calls here. Michael, you talked to our soldiers before they head out to Iraq, Afghanistan, other places. Do you talk to them when they come back?
No, I wish I did, although at this point, many of them are, I see the same groups repeatedly as they go on multiple deployments. I did see a decommissioning recently in Iowa, but that was just by chance. But I got to say, that was one of the most moving experiences in my life.
Yeah,
demobilization. I'm sorry, not decommissioning.
I'll bet. What do you suppose? Maybe you've picked this up. When they come back, they shake their heads about. They're most surprised about. Most bewildered about.
It's always the same. They see far more success in their areas of operation than the depression, the collective depression that affects the U.S. media is willing to acknowledge.
All right, so where they are, they're working, they're successful, right?
Well, I mean, they're working, they're successful, and simply put, they recognize that the Afghans have no desire to live under a group like the Taliban. Somehow the media thinks that people want to live with this lack of liberty.
Yeah, that's what I got out of this book, is that, they get a lot of help from villagers. They do get attacked, but when they attack back. And superior firepower, use of Apaches, other things. I mean, they really clobber these guys. And then they shake their heads when they hear reports that it's a standoff or standstill.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah. All right, let's go to calls. Great, wonderful calls. I'm not filtering these at all, just as they come to you, Michael. Joe is in Voorhees, New Jersey. You're on, Joe, with Michael Rubin.
Hi, Michael. Great work. Thanks very much. Thank you, Dr. Bennett.
Yep.
Michael, so let's say June 6, 1944 is 66 years less a few days away, where we've been occupying foreign soil. Short of that, in places in the Middle East like Afghanistan and Pakistan, I mean, do we have a plan for that? Because otherwise, if we're not looking, I don't see anything in between here. I'd like your thoughts on that. If it's not a multi-generational occupation for pacification, which we've done with Germany and Japan, frankly, why are we there at all? I mean, it's
Thank
either
you.
One of those two questions.
That's a very good question. Basically, that's why all the focus, both in Iraq and in Afghanistan, has been building up the armies in Iraq or Afghanistan, so that the Afghans and the Iraqis could do it on their own.
Can they?
Increasingly, they can, better than they could several years ago. But it won't be a multi-generational task, but it will certainly be a multi-year task to make sure that they do.
But will they be ready July 2011?
Probably not.
Yeah, so we'll have to stay, won't we?
Yes.
Will he yank them, do you think?
That's the question in everyone's mind, but so long as that's a question, that undercuts our ability to be effective right now.
Absolutely. Let's go to Alan in Dallas. Hi, Alan. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. Mr. Rubin, I have a question for you. Now, I know this sounds like a stupid question, but just bear with me. Since Clinton was elected over the past 20 years, we have had primarily nothing but female secretaries of state. Other than Colin Powell. And by and large, every one of them has been a failure in dealing with this radical Muslim leadership. And is it possible that they, being they treat their women so badly anyway, is it possible that they have no respect for our female Secretary of State?
Secretary of State can't get it done if she's a woman.
That's a very good question, but
it is a good question, is it?
It is, but I think that the greater problem is simply this: our own projection and our own willing to recognize our lack of willingness to recognize reality on the other side. I mean, frankly, I hate to say this, but I'd much rather have Madeleine Albright than Warren Christopher at times, as well as sometimes it's useful to send a woman and have her be our top diplomat so that the radical Islamists see what it actually means, and frankly, so that all the women in the radical Islamist countries see what freedom means.
So,
I don't think the gender is the problem. I think it's more the culture of our own diplomacy that's too willing to apologize and sees strength and power as a fault.
Yeah, all right, all right, yeah. You know, there's hypocrisy over there, too, on this. So I'll never forget, right after 9/11, we took a private plane, Seth and I. Well, wasn't it you and I, Seth?
Yeah, where is it, over at the Dulles? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. At Dulles, we saw a Saudi delegation getting into a private plane. We don't know if they were flying overseas or not. But the thing that we noticed, Michael, was a female pilot.
Indeed.
In charge, yeah. Interesting, huh? Where was she trained? I don't know. But they didn't seem to object, you know? She wasn't wearing a veil, either.
No, indeed. But I seem to also remember that at one point, when I think it was King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia was visiting President Bush's ranch in Texas, the pilot of the Saudi plane refused to deal with female air traffic controllers.
That's right.
Yeah, it's a little pick and choose, isn't it?
Yeah, well, at which point, if I were a female air traffic controller, I would simply say, okay, goodbye, hang up, and you're on your own.
don't hit the gas dump button while you're up there.
Good luck. Here's one, a little off our topic, but I'd love to know what you think. Bill is in Spokane. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, Mr. Bennett?
Yeah.
My question for Michael is has to do with OPEC. I'm not sure how many nations it is comprised of now, 8, 10, 12, but is the situation between Israel and Turkey, is OPEC have any importance in it?
It's a great question. Answer is not directly. However, lots of people are realists, and we don't understand that. We tend to figure that realism talks about means maximizing our own interests. We forget that our adversaries maximize their interests. And so while there's tension going on in the region, it wouldn't be unusual for OPEC to try to take advantage of that to make a little bit more money in their pocketbook.
We're talking to Michael Rubin. If you want to call, with last chance, 866-680-6464. Let's go back to Iraq. How are things going in Iraq? How do you see them now?
Things are going pretty well. The big issue in Iraq right now is the lack of government, of course, and the cutoff date for that is actually August, because August is the month of Ramadan. Nothing's going to happen in August, so the question is whether the Iraqis are going to be able to form a government before then. What is amazing, though, is how well Iraq seems to be functioning when the government isn't really interfering in things.
Tell us about some of the other places where Dubai, where what's his name, Al-Awlaki is, escapes me at the moment.
Al-Awlaki in Yemen.
Yemen. Tell us about Yemen. Tell us about Dubai. Tell us about other places which we should have some concern or not.
Well, it's actually, the great news hook for this is, of course, June 4th is the first year anniversary of President Obama's speech in Cairo. But when we look at some of the problems, Yemen is actually a problem that should be on more people's radar screen. It's not just the presence of al-Qaeda and this rebellion in the north, which is quiet right now but could break out at any time. I was just talking to a good friend of mine who is Yemeni who won a big award from Gallup. He was telling me about how more Yemenis are concerned that the civil war between North and South Yemen could break out as it did last in 1994, that once again, when we're looking elsewhere, we could have war in the Arabian Peninsula.
Do we have al-Qaeda pretty much on the run in most places?
It's on one hand, it's whack-a-mole. On the other hand, it's important to play whack-a-mole to make sure that the moles don't get out of control. The fact of the matter is al-Qaeda looks for safe havens. It tried to get one in Yemen. We denied that to them. It's tried to get one in Afghanistan. We denied that to them. There is now a major problem in Somalia as well with the Islamic Court Union and al-Qaeda affiliate taking over about half the country. It remains to be seen whether President Obama is prepared to deal with that.
What would it take to deal with Somalia?
Well, what's happened in the past is that the Ethiopians have actually gone in and cleared out the Islamists inside Somalia whenever the Islamists threatened to get out of control, What's ironic is oftentimes the United Nations would then come in and say, oh, this is horrible, the Ethiopian army is coming in. What we've got to do is form some sort of coalition government that includes this al-Qaeda affiliate, which is just typical United Nations Kool-Aid, and that's the type of thing that's got to stop. We've got to understand that we've got to defeat our adversaries, not necessarily just co-opt them.
Now, I mentioned Dubai. I know it's not in the same category, and it's certainly a hotbed, not of terrorism, but of commercialism and growth and building and so on. But we had that debate on the ports, and during that time it came out that there was a fair amount of sympathy in Dubai for some of our enemies. Is that the case?
Well, on one hand, there's a little bit of sympathy just when it comes to hard-knuckle politics. But on the other hand, Dubai represents one pole in a vision. Perhaps Saudi Arabia represents the other. When you go to the Middle East, you can see on satellite television, for example, the religious programming, the Hezbollah television station on one hand, and then you can see the cafes in Beirut, the indoor ski resorts in Dubai, and I'd much rather have Arabs aspiring towards this extreme capitalism of Dubai or this lifestyle of Beirut than the other way around.
All right, and final question, Iran and Israel, do you still see this as a possible confrontation in the near future?
This is increasingly dangerous, and the fact of the matter is the whole Turkey-Israel conflict sidetracks the efforts of the United Nations, sidetracks the international consensus, and that Iran isn't going to stop. The trajectory is all wrong. When President Obama came in, Iran didn't have enough fuel for a nuclear weapon. Then last year it had one. Now it has enough fuel for two nuclear weapons. Right. Clearly the strategy isn't working.
Do you believe that we would side with Israel if attacked?
I'm not sure at this point.
Really?
And frankly, if Israel doesn't think we would, they might act more unilaterally. If Iran doesn't think we would, they might act more unilaterally.
Apart from human and moral issues of enormous consequence and order and magnitude,
absolutely.
Politically, could Barack Obama survive losing Israel?
Barack Obama seems to be willing to, he's willing to fight to the last congressman who's not him. The fact of the matter is he's taken a lot of hits, his popularity has plummeted, but he's shown himself to be ideological and simply not to care.
Yeah, unbelievable. Michael, just a great tour. Thank you so much. Enlightened us. Thank you very, very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Enormously grateful, and especially for your teaching of our troops. We appreciate that very much, sending them off smarter. Michael Rubin, resident scholar, American Enterprise Institute. We'll be back with you.